Friday, April 18th, 2025, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. So other than interviews, I don't think there was a single segment this week which didn't touch on tariffs, the economy, possibly the fauna of Heard and McDonald Islands. No tango. Put the sardine down and disengage from predatory pricing. By the way, I did find out that those islands with no structures or human inhabitants do somehow show up on official government statistics as having exports. The experts are not sure how, but when you're not sure how, slap a tariff on them, I say. And I'll tell you what else I read besides McDonald and Heard Island export coverage. Well, not that much. I read about bonds, I read about tariffs, I read about markets, I read about equity flows, all that. But I only barely hear that the Congo hostages were released and also that there were hostages in Congo. I did catch up on a lawsuit between Build-A-Bear and Squishmallows, I think the name is. I'm sure that's going to be a three-parter on The Gist soon. But one story that I got to today and that I read, it was in the New York Times, has left a fact buried, just lodged in my brain. It was, in fact, a fact about things lodged in our brains. The Times reports that a New Mexico research team found out that human brains today contain 50% more microplastics than they did in 2016. But that's not the fact. Here's the fact. The researchers reported the median concentration of microplastics was nearly 5,000 micrograms per gram. That's about 7 grams of plastic per brain, as much as makes up a disposable spoon. Whoa, whoa, whoa. We're walking around with a spoon in the brain? Duh, Mike, not literally, though maybe literally. I don't know. How am I supposed to decide? I have a spoon in the brain. Okay, so here's what they're saying. If you add up all those tiny nano and microplastics inside of cells, a lot of them are inside of the cells, sort of like the dust in the air, but in the cells of the brain, and you do some math, you find 5,000 micrograms of plastic per gram of brain. 5,000 micrograms is 5 milligrams. Do the math, because human brains have 1,400 grams on average. 7 grams of plastic exist in the brain. And a plastic spoon, I looked this up too, weighs 2 to 6 grams. So that actually means we have 3 plastic spoons in the brain. Yeah, I know people are going to hear this and say, Mike, not literally, you know, it's tiny parts per thousand and they're kind of tucked in there and blah, blah, blah. And if you isolated all the non-spoon parts of the brain from the spoon parts of the brain, what this is saying, and you can't get around this, somehow you add the centrifuge, the brain centrifuge that extracted all the plastic, after that, you'd have 1,393 grams of non-spoon brain, and you'd have 7 grams of spoon in the brain. And I say this is impossible. I do not believe it. I mean, if we believe this, maybe certain parts of the brain have higher concentrations, right? Maybe there's a prefrontal cortex or a spatula oblongata. I think the world exploding from tariffs is actually slightly more comforting than this information. But like I say, I literally don't believe it. But like I also say, definitely don't trust me. My brain is 0.5% spoon. On the show today, McCarthyism gets applied to all manner of social phenomenon these days. Any tactic that relies on guilt by association or conspiracy theory or leveraging the powers of suggestion and allegations of disloyalty for cynical political aims. But during the actual McCarthy era, those tactics weren't hinted at or inferred if you looked at them the right way. They rode roughshod over society. But it is also true that there are clear vestiges of McCarthyism today. And as my guest argues, not just vestiges. The DNA of Joe McCarthy can be found in so many political actors and tactics in the present. My guest is Clay Risen, and for the rest of the show, we shall discuss his fascinating book, Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. Clay Risen, up next. The McCarthy era was a formative and terrible experience in American history. And also, it resonates to today, so argues Clay Risen. the author of Red Scare, Blacklists, McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. A lot of books have those subtitles, right? And what went on then is going on now. But this one makes the case pretty well. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the history. Clay Risen is here. Clay, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So the argument of the book is manifold. And I want to get to all that. And I want to get to the history. And I want to talk about today. But I don't want to leap past what the book does so well, which is it told me, and I know a lot about the Blacklist, it surfaced many stories that I had never even heard of. Pick one. Pick a character who's probably lost to even someone who read Naming Names by Victor
Navasky. Yeah.
And who watched a lot of documentaries about the about McCarthyism. There are many that I didn't even know about. Pick one.
Yeah. Okay. So one person I haven't talked about in some of my interviews, but I really was fascinated by, was Sterling Hayden.
Yes.
Who is
Captain McCluskey.
Yes,
takes it, so in, the, takes it
today,
in the neck by Michael
Captain
Corleone.
Captain McCluskey. He was also, appeared in Dr. Strangelove.
Right, General Ripper, right?
Yeah, he's General Ripper. But his past is fascinating. Just to give a quick picture, he was a sailor. He didn't want to go into Hollywood, but he ended up in California, and he was sort of picked out because he was a really good looking dude.
Yeah.
And he was cast in
tall,
all these
strapping.
Yeah. And so he was cast in a bunch of, sort of B movies. He hated it. And so when World War II came around, he signed up for the military, and he ended up working for the OSS and was parachuted into Yugoslavia. He fought with the partisans. He got to know Tito personally. And as a result, he sort of had this romantic idea about communism. So after the war, he went back to Hollywood and he joined the party very briefly. And he realized, this communism is not the communism I knew. I don't want anything to do with this. So he left very quickly.
It's not Tito's communism.
Yeah. Well, I think he just became more of a realist. Mm-hmm.
But Tito was a U.S. ally.
Yeah,
and wasn't
sure. And right. I mean, he wasn't a Soviet communist. But in any case, years later, in 1953, Hayden was fingered as a communist. And so he was, required to name names, and he was called by the House Un-American Activities Committee to come forward. He got a lawyer.
Yeah.
The lawyer basically said, and this was a guy who did this for everybody. The lawyer said, you've got to do it.
Yeah.
Your career's over. You got to do it. Hayden,
your career's over if you don't do it.
Right.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. You got
to
do it.
And at that time, to set the tone, to give the setting, many had testified already.
Mm-hmm.
Many had named names, and they've named, I think you put in the book, like 908 names at that point.
Yeah. Yes. And some people named a lot. Some people named a few. The lawyer said, look, at this point, this is all just a degradation ceremony. Everybody knows all the names.
Yep.
There's no secret. You're not going to reveal something, but you have to do it. Just to bend the knee to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And it's terrible, and it's anti-American. And the thing, Hayden was recently divorced, and he didn't want to lose his kids. That was really the thing. He didn't care about Hollywood. He didn't want to lose his kids. So he did it. And
because this is how lives were destroyed.
Yes, this is how lives were destroyed.
So it wasn't just taking of your money. The courts would follow up. Just the institutions of society would look at a person who either didn't testify or was found in violation. That was it. It was over for them on so many levels.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And Hayden, he did testify. He named names of people he already knew.
Two names.
They were people who had already been fingered. He said, I don't remember the rest. And he was valorized by Hollywood, the conservative side of Hollywood. Here's somebody, a good American who went along, he got contracts, and he writes, he has, I would recommend people, if you're curious about Sterling Hayden, his memoir is fantastic. It's called Wanderer. He's a really great writer. And he recounts this, and he says, years afterward, people would come up to me and they would say, hey, you did a great thing for America. And he would say, you don't understand how much I hate myself.
Yeah.
You don't. And
he would get jobs in Westerns, which he hated.
He hated Westerns.
He lived on a series of houseboats and he moved out of L.A.
Yeah, he lived in Sausalito.
Like, right, this is a guy who, in the continuum of heroes or Clifford Odets or the whole continuum of did you name names or didn't you? He did the very reasonable thing that I think almost all of us or if we were decent people would do. And it still ruined him. They weren't ruining communists. They weren't ruining far left leftists, and they weren't just going after people who had, you know, some association they needed to apologize for. Hayden was seen, he played heroes in the movies, and it ruined him. Why? Because he had a conscience, unlike McCarthy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, I mean, the thing that really jumps out for me is that story, right? You can look on the surface and say, wow, and his best roles, the roles we remember him for, were ahead of him.
Yeah.
You know, he really became famous after all this.
The reason why Wanderer gets published is because he was those roles we talked about.
But when you hear from him, you find out, oh, the destruction was all internal. And that's something I think sometimes, that's what I wanted to communicate through the book, was that even people who collaborated were often destroyed internally. And so the costs weren't measured simply in how many people were fired, how many people were blacklisted, but was also how many consciences were destroyed. And that's immeasurable.
Yeah.
But it's easy to say, you know, this affected the entire country. And that's, I think, what I wanted to get across with the book.
And so we know about Sterling Hayden because he was Sterling Hayden. He wrote a memoir about it. There are countless people who were teachers, who were civil servants, who were low-level members of the armed forces. And they were probably in the exact same
position. Yeah, I mean, there's another guy that I talk about in a chapter on education. He was a Slovakian immigrant.
Havlaski?
Julius Hlavati.
Yeah.
And he grew up poor in New York, but he went through the public school system. He ended up getting a PhD from Columbia, and he taught math at Bronx Science, and he was widely considered the best math teacher in America. And
Bronx Science, to interrupt, has produced more Nobel laureates than Spain, Mexico. I can name most countries.
I mean, Bronx
it's
Science.
It's not an exaggeration.
Right. So he's literally teaching the future best and the brightest at a time when America claimed, hey, we need to be at the forefront. We are
need
in a Cold War.
Part of the reason there's a Red Scare is because of our scientific vulnerabilities to the Soviets. Yes.
And Hlavati, like a lot of teachers, was an idealist. And in the 1930s, he had associated with, he was still a member of the American Labor Party, which was a left wing party in the United States. But he was called down to Congress in front of Joe McCarthy. And they asked him, are you a communist? Have you ever been a communist? And he said, look, I'm not going to tell you, but I know now that by not telling you, my life is over when I get back to New York. And sure enough, a few weeks later, he was hauled in front of the Board of Education and summarily fired.
Yeah.
And his wife, for good measure, was also fired. She was a teacher. And I came across him just because there was a little squib in the newspaper and I was doing, searches for keywords, and I came across his story and I thought what a story if I can unpack this. And I got in touch with his son, who is still around, and we talked about his dad. And for me, it was just this, the nail on the head, the final stitch for this is that, so his one book was basically a book of math problems, of geometry problems. It was a primer for middle school kids and really almost no text. And it was very popular. It was in libraries around the country. It was in our State Department libraries overseas. It was removed.
The math problems.
The math problems.
Communist math was going on.
Yeah, exactly. And he wrote a very angry letter to the New York Times. I mean, not against the Times, but explaining, this is ridiculous. This is he didn't say it this way, but this is a giant cell phone by the United States. You know, regardless of what you think of me, this is a book that everyone is benefiting from, and it's being removed for just irrational reasons. And to me, that just was so much, it just boiled down the insanity of the era into, a few hundred words. And that's what made me just jump out at him as a character.
Yeah, there was so much countenancing of collateral damage for, and this is where your book, I think, separates itself from a lot of the other scholarship and writing about the period, for the bona fide worry about communism. And it was bona fide, and it was real. And Julius and Ethel Rosenberg did sell secrets to the Soviets. Don't think, especially Ethel, should have been executed.
Why?
But yes. But this was real. It was a real concern. The communists weren't just a boogeyman under your bed. They were an evil empire oppressing people. And for many years afterwards, that wasn't acknowledged as much. I guess the people who were writing about it, who were most aggrieved, maybe had some associations or, you know, knew people in their families who were red diaper babies or whatever. But the collateral damage got to be so great that I think it was more defining of the era than the actual program, which was the legitimate opposition to communism.
Well, look, I mean, no one was ever found, no subversives or spies were ever found through the federal loyalty programs. The Hollywood blacklist didn't remove communism or the boogeyman. I mean, it was all made up. You know, what did get the Rosenbergs, for example, or Alger Hiss, was just law enforcement. I mean, the FBI had a role to play, and the FBI did its role in those cases very well. They hunted down the Rosenbergs, and that's what should have been done and nothing else. And maybe you have a loyalty program that's very well designed and respects civil liberties, but instead we had this loyalty program that was just gave carte blanche to anonymous gossip and didn't allow the accused to confront their accuser or even know the evidence against them.
Well, tell me about the loyalty program. How was it instituted?
What were the aspects of it? Yeah, so the loyalty program began under Harry S. Truman, and it was, in some ways, it was really just a sop to the political moment. You know, the 1946 elections had really gone against the Democrats. Truman was new in office. He was back on his heels.
There was the widespread notion that this guy's no FDR.
Yeah, exactly. And also, the Cold War was starting up. There was evidence of subversion. I mean, in the United States, and espionage. And so there was enough chatter where he felt like, I need to do something to at least make it look like I'm taking a stand. You know, Truman maybe is naive. I think probably naive in a way, but He didn't believe any of this. You know, he didn't believe that there was a communist threat. He was never a red baiter at all. And so
he had a rational belief that, of course, our intelligence apparatus has to be patrolled.
Yeah, of course.
And we have spies there. They have spies here.
Yeah.
He knew that. Yeah.
But he also didn't believe that the Red Scare could happen. And so he signed an executive order creating this loyalty program that was basically, I think in his mind, was going to be just this bureaucratic box check where we're going to go around, we're going to talk to everybody, ask them, are you a communist? And if you say no, great. But the way it took off from there and the way it really metastasized was far beyond what he expected. And it had no guardrails. And so, you know, pretty quickly, every agency had to have a loyalty board. The FBI was deeply involved in these investigations, and it moved very quickly. And suddenly, people were being accused for obvious political reasons or for opportunistic personal reasons.
Yeah.
The other thing that I don't think Truman really appreciated was that by doing this, he gave a green light to everybody else to do it. Because suddenly, if the president says this is a concern, then, you know, private industry and local governments can
We're seeing that now with the DEI crackdown.
Yeah.
You know, the government does something and private industry says, well, we're going to not fund pride parades or we're not going to have a scholarship program.
If you feel like this is the way the wind is blowing,
then
you're going to follow suit pretty quickly. And it was amazing how quickly everyone, I want to say fell in line, but Truman wasn't even telling anyone else to do it. It was more that the vibe, the environment changed so quickly, and that the incentive structure
did changed. McCarthy understand that? He was good at certain aspects of what he did, dealing with the media, red baiting. He was good at red baiting. Did he have a better or more global understanding of that aspect, how society would work without actual dictates, but with just vibes?
Yeah, I think he had an instinctual understanding. You know, by the time he came around, the Red Scare, so he came on the scene as a national figure in the early 1950, and it was right after the Hiss conviction. So it was in the air. Hiss had been a high-ranking State Department official, so the idea that there were spies in the State Department was had some validity among the public.
Yes.
And I think McCarthy, it's important that the Red Scare had already been going on because he could sort of leap into the stream that was flowing in the direction he wanted. And so in some ways, he understood the moment. He was able to distill it down. I write in the book that, you know, he wasn't the cause, but he was a symptom in a lot of ways.
And that's true with a lot of extremism. Yeah, right? You write about extremism today. This is a debate. Hey, yeah. Did Donald Trump cause the degradation of principles within the Republican Party? No, he probably just, you know, took advantage of it.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, McCarthy was so effective, was because he was able to identify exactly where that stream was going and to take advantage of it. He knew that if he said certain things, people were not going to push back.
Right, right, right. Because the cost to them, they would say, well, we'll get by, or we're just doing this as a sop word you used before to this ridiculous character. Yeah. The fact that he was really seen as ridiculous and should have been. He was an alcoholic and gambled too much. And like the things he said didn't, you know, he just would lie and lie and lie and they'd catch him in a lie and lie and lie. And then he'd go on to the next lie.
I mean, I think it's important that if McCarthy had come around in 1946, I think he would have not been as successful because people would have seen his extremism and his clownishness and said, oh, this is just over the top. This whole thing, this whole enterprise, this whole Red Scare is ridiculous. But the fact that he came along in 1950, people were used to it. And they were, you know, I mean, I think we're unfortunately entering another period, or already have, where people are willing to see gross civil rights violations and just say, oh, that's how things are today.
Yeah.
And that's what happened in the Red Scare. People were just, you'd hear some terrible story about someone who's, you know, was fired for almost no reason, or they were blacklisted for a ridiculous reason. And it would be a squib in the newspaper because no one thought it was weird. It was a dog bites man story.
Yeah, or people want to be self-protective, or you fight your battles, or people, this is a big thing, people congratulate themselves on being sophisticated enough not to fall into that trap. Like, I know how to navigate these waters. I'm not Sterling Hayden. I didn't meet with Tito. Things like that. Or I'm not this guy from Bronx Science. I see where the wind is blowing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it's why so few senators. I mean, Margaret Chase Smith deserves an enormous amount of credit. She stood up in very early on. She was a senator from Maine, Maine Republican. She stood up in June of 1950 and gave a speech on the floor of the Senate where she just called out McCarthy and just ripped into him. And, you know, she had a statement of conscience that she asked everyone to sign on to. Only four senators, and she was one of them, two of them backed out, and the third, Wayne Morse, switched parties.
Yeah.
So, you know, it wasn't, she was, you know, deserves an enormous amount of credit because she took a lot of heat for this. It was early on, but she was also made an example of, and so no one else spoke up for years afterward. I mean, Democrats did, but no one in the Republican Party until 1954 was willing to stand up to McCarthy.
We'll be back with more of Clay Risen, author of Red Scare, and he'll explain why today a lot of people might be looking around saying, oh wow, McCarthy won. And we're back with Clay Risen, author of Red Scare, Blacklist McCarthyism, and the Making of Modern America. And in this part, I want to address the partisan breakdown of all this, because we have to remember at the time the parties were not clearly right and left. A lot of Southern Democrats were very conservative, very much allies of McCarthy. And there were parts of McCarthyism that were less popular with Republicans than Democrats, right? I mean, one of the things we say, McCarthy was a Republican senator from Wisconsin, but some of his biggest allies were Democrats from Nevada, Pat McCarran. He was very much into this.
Yeah, Pat McCarran was very much a McCarthyite.
When you're flying to that airport. And
yeah, it's still the Las Vegas, the McCarran Airport.
I
think that's really funny. I mean, the Republicans, one reason why you didn't see more Republicans stand up is this is 1950, 1952. The Republicans had thought they were going to win the presidency in 1948, and Truman came roaring back. And
Dewey did not defeat Truman.
And Dewey had refused to run on communism and refused to red bait. And the lesson of that was we need to lean into this.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was very hard for Republicans to say, you know, this McCarthy guy, is helping us out. You know, he is, and McCarthy was a, in that regard, a team player. Like, if you were a friend of his, or if you were on his side, he would fly into your state and he would give a barn burner speech and it would help you in your race.
I think if the primary system then looked like the primary system now, this would have been figured out during the primaries and the whole party would have been redefined as a anti-communist party. And then you got to wonder what Eisenhower would have done.
Absolutely.
He still would have been elected. That's how popular he was. But as hard a choice as he had to do the decent thing or to stand up to this faction in his party that probably supported a lot of his agenda, it would be that much harder if it was clear that this party was a pro red baiting party.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it took years before, and I think it really took the presence of Eisenhower to sort of lock in the in his victory to kind of lock in Republican dominance, so that dissenters within the party or opponents of McCarthy could start to feel like they can stand up. And even then, it took, you know, a year before any senator, you know, Ralph Flanders was the first senator. He was from Vermont. He was a flinty old
Vermont
rock
was
rib.
Very Republican state.
But old school, small town Republican. And it took him well over a year after Eisenhower's victory to stand up and essentially give his version of what Margaret Chase Smith had said 4 years earlier, but he ripped into McCarthy and that made a difference. I mean, Flanders was a really, you know, he's one of these quiet guys that you never heard from until he got his back up and he went after McCarthy viciously. You know, he was one of, I think, you know, when you tell the story of McCarthy's downfall, Flanders sometimes gets forgotten. It's not like he was the decisive force, but it mattered that a Republican stood up and just so clearly indicted McCarthy.
I know there are not a lot of international flights into Rutland, but name an airport after that guy, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
By the way, total side note, I have said for a long time that one of the worst things that happened to American politics was the ideological sorting of the parties.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something that the political science advocated for, and E. E. Schatzsnyder did a, you know, the journals of political science said, this is so unreasonable that the parties are not ideological. Sorted. And I've always likened it to dogs. And when you have purebred dogs, there's more genetic problems. And there's a lot of examples like this. When you have a weird mixing of different interests in a group, you'll get oftentimes much better outcomes.
Oh, absolutely.
And so when I look, I always thought of it with the civil rights era. I never thought of it as much with the red baiting era, but it's so true.
One of my previous books was a history of the making of the Civil Rights Act. And that's absolutely the case. I mean, there were all kinds of Republicans and all kinds of Democrats. And of course, the Southern Democrats were the big hurdle.
Yeah.
And so much of what made that bill possible and made it possible in this very, you know, I mean, it's amazing how big the Civil Rights Act is, was because there were so many liberal and maverick Republicans. It could never happen today because everyone is just, there's a party line, there's an ideology, and if you don't fit in, you're out.
Yeah. Well, this brings me to the New Deal. And this is one of your, you have two great theses about this and then about what caused this. So one is it's a reaction to the New Deal. The New Deal was really all-encompassing in American life. And conservatives, I think it's fair to say conservatives objected. And it wasn't always really clear how these objections would find full flower. And sometimes they just leaked out in these really malignant ways. And so you say that the Democrats got the New Deal. It was remaking society. The right kind of goes nuts about it. And a consequence of that is the Red Scare.
Yeah. I mean, the New Deal, it was so much more than just a policy agenda, right? It really was a culture. There's a great book that came out in the 1990s called The Cultural Front by Michael Denning. And he makes this case. He says, you know, the 1930s was about music and theater, you know, as much as it was about policy. But this was all intertwined because people would be, you know, out building a dam. And then, you know, they would hear, you know, folk songs, and maybe they would go to a traveling, you know, Federal Theater Project presentation.
Yeah.
It was really all of a piece. And politically, it was this grand coalition, the Popular Front of New Deal Democrats all the way to communists who deeply disagreed on a lot of things, but they could get behind this project.
Yeah.
But as you said, there was a lot of opposition to that. There were a lot of people for, you know, reasonable economic or political reasons, but also some deeply conspiratorial wingnut stuff. And often that had its own sort of spectrum and coalition. But it was suppressed by the headiness of the time and the urgency of the time. You know, this is the Great Depression. And then, of course, World War II comes around, and all of that gets sort of set on the back burner. And it's only after the war that this fight, this kind of simmering cultural conflict, comes back to the front.
So we've been like repressing it. It's been building up. We can't acknowledge it. We have a war to fight. We could all agree that the Nazis are the enemies. The Nazis are defeated, and we have this festering cultural wound that hasn't the right that hasn't been addressed.
Yeah, yeah. And that intersects in a very violent way with the Cold War and the onset of this absolute black and white security mindset in which anything that has the slightest whiff of communism is suspect and has to be rooted out, right? And then, of course, that comes around to indict this whole coalition, the whole Popular Front. If you were someone who protested against Franco, well, you know who else protested against Franco? Communists.
Yeah, fellow travelers.
Fellow travelers. And maybe you weren't even, I mean, there were people who were active fellow travelers. They associated or sort of cozied up. There were some people who didn't, but they simply held similar views.
Yeah. And so, also, communists were pre-Stalin not as discredited as they were. Communists helped us defeat the Nazis.
And there was a range of communists. I mean, especially in the rank and file, you had people who, you know, wanted nothing more than to be inspired by a utopian political vision, right? There were communists, particularly in the leadership, who were in collaboration with Moscow and did facilitate espionage. But it became a blanket indictment.
Yes.
You know, if you ever signed a petition, if you gave money to this group, then we've got to talk. And of course, Hollywood, being Hollywood, was a place where people had really leapt into this. And now all of a sudden, all of these actors and actresses and writers were looking over their shoulders because they were at a party. They were at the wrong party. You know, same thing with teachers, postal workers, labor activists. I mean, you name it. They were suddenly civil rights activists. They were suddenly suspect. And that became the fodder for the Red Scare, right? So many of the way the Red Scare played out, you know, there was a there, but ultimately, in my interpretation, it was this cultural conflict.
Yes.
That pitted these two visions of America.
Yes.
And I think, not to get ahead of myself, but that's also one of the big legacies of the Red Scare.
But also, Americans are a little nutty. And I know that you address this idea, but as you point out, the Brits had a lot to worry about with communists and Kim Philby, and there were communist infiltration, and it was real, and Ted Hall, and there are a lot of communists in Great Britain and in France and Italy, you know, the Red Army Brigade. Mm-hmm. These were real communist organizations killing people out in the open. They didn't have the equivalents of the Red Scare.
I mean, that
and
was,
part of it is, like you say, it was a reaction to the New Deal, which those countries didn't have. But I do think part of it was just America, and Kurt Anderson and others have written about it. Our character is, we go in these extremist waves.
Yeah. And and I think, I mean, that was when I started thinking about the book, that comparative aspect was something that really got me started. And you're right. I mean, I don't think it's hard to deny that there is a craziness that kind of comes in and out. As a historian, that is both an explanation, but not sufficient to me. I wanted to explain. I mean, my question really was,
why
did it happen this way at this time? Why did it end? And so, you know, it's sort of a predicate to say, well, this is something that happens every once in a while, and it's part of our character. I was interested in the specifics of this event, this period. But I think, yes, there is something about our character, our, you know, there's something in the water that gives us over to these moments that, particularly in the Red Scare, but in others.
Well, we were founded in revolution. We don't go back hundreds of years. But they also, the Scotch Irish settled the South. Yeah. All of these reasons.
No, but there's an irony because so much of it goes against our purported founding beliefs.
I mean,
the First Amendment is the bedrock of civil liberties, and yet from time to time we openly violate it.
Yeah.
And we celebrate the violations of this thing that we're supposed to hold at the highest, it was almost a Ten Commandment.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we are very happy to get rid of it. And then later on, we look back and say, oh, God, that was a mistake.
Well, what did the civil liberties apparatus, such as they were, what were they doing? Because the ACLU did not cover themselves in glory.
They did not look good, partly because, you know, to be seen defending communists was, or even to speak up for civil liberties was to be seen as anti-American and going against the national interest at a time when supposedly, you know, we were about to go to war with the Soviet Union. And so the ACLU, the American Bar Association, really, I mean, they didn't just stand down, they ran the other way and often, you know, indicted their own members if they spoke out too much.
Well, I think, but you tell me, that many of the institutions you have named that are identified as progressive today, Hollywood, the New York Times, which wrote about our Bronx science teacher, the Bar Association, now they're very, very left progressive. Then I don't think they were.
No. And there was also, you know, there was as much as there was the Red Scare between left and right, there was also the Red Scare also had a valence on the left, and the war between non-communist, anti-communist liberals and the left was almost as destructive as the Red Scare itself. I mean, it tore apart the labor movement. It decimated that coalition between left and center that had driven Roosevelt forward, that had, you know, lasted through the Truman era, but then in 1948 and then afterward, really just ended in civil war on the left, and a lot of those organizations aligned with the liberals against the communists.
But lest someone have
the progressives, let's say,
lest someone have just pure nostalgia for the coalition between the center and the left. You know, that was a coalition that had FDR make accommodations for Theodore Bilbo, the Mississippi senator, basically the whole New Deal was stripped of any civil rights because the guy was a vicious racist, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, it is quite something that there was a coalition that went from Bilbo all the way to, you know, the head of the Communist Party. It's to Roosevelt's credit, such as it is, that he was able to hold that together.
Yeah.
But there were enormous costs.
Yeah.
Right? Because he was not able to, say, extend a lot of the benefits of the New Deal to African Americans.
I asked you about the institutions of civil liberties. This is what I was wondering about. It seems like the story is Eisenhower is a smart guy and a very decent person, and in his guts he hates it, but eventually McCarthy is so weakened that Eisenhower and those aligned with him can do something about it. But it seemed more predicated, or the opposition to the Red Scare seemed more predicated on the decency of individuals than anything institutional. I wonder today, maybe because we've been through the Red Scare, but this will get us to the section of our interview where we talk about how similar and how dissimilar it is. I wonder if today, if that were going on, today we point to, well, here's what we know about civil liberties, and here's what we know about civil liberty law, and here's what we don't even have to think about or work through from a moral standpoint. We just know that it's wrong. Was that going on then? Were there enough people who were respected thinkers or a body of work where you could point to what America is that could discredit the Red Scare?
Yes and no. I mean, it certainly existed, but there were too many people who were willing to set that aside. I mean, the Supreme Court itself is a great example where you had people like Hugo Black and William O. Douglas who were just adamant pro-civil liberties. And anytime a Red Scare case came before them, they were guaranteed to be, unfortunately, dissenting. And they were leaning on a pretty established reading of the First Amendment and of, you know, civil liberties law broadly. And yet they didn't have a majority. They just, even when Felix Frankfurter, who was sort of, you know, had a nuanced read of things, even when he joined with them, there were just too many justices who were willing to set things aside. And you didn't have, I mean, in Carl Vinson, who was the Supreme Court Chief Justice, yeah, for much of it, you just didn't have, he was not a leader. He wasn't going to push things. It was only when Earl Warren came in 1953, and Warren, to the surprise of many people, turned out to be this civil libertarian. He sort of had this Saul on the road to Damascus conversion and lined up with the strong. I mean, he was, there was no distance between him and Hugo Black. Everyone was surprised about that. This is the guy who supported putting Japanese
Republican governor of California,
them in concentration camps. And yet now here he is going after piece by piece the Red Scare. And so, you know, I guess to answer your question, it took leadership by certain people to line up what was otherwise this kind of disparate community of civil libertarians, of thinkers who to some extent had been speaking out or had been a little quiet. Once they started to see things turn, they were able to kind of rally. And I think, I mean, this is my personal interpretation, my reading in the book, is that Warren deserves an enormous amount of credit for not only doing the hard work, you know, going through all these laws, but also standing up and saying, okay, now the Supreme Court is on the right side. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right, too, that there is the Red Scare did leave behind antibodies in the sense that organizations like the ACLU could look back and say, well, we made a mistake. We've learned from that. And I think one of the things that is maybe a silver lining of all of this is that then in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, so much of the rights revolution was supported by groups like the ACLU that said, we can't go, you know, we've learned our lesson. We can't go back to that.
Yes.
And the idea.
And then they also burnished, this is a period where they burnished their credentials by taking on popular cases, cases that, you know, the Nazis and Skokie and all these cases. And they become, not to everyone, but certainly a figure of, or an institution of respect.
Yes. Absolutely. And I think it remains to be seen how that plays out today. Because one of the things in the book, one of the literary references that I touch on is
and that is the dreaded fade out. A good interview. We didn't hold back. You got a lot here, but if you want to finish the meal, Pesca Plus subscribers get even more of Clay Rising. Go to subscribe.mikepesca.com. You get bonus episodes, bonus features. On the 24th of this month, Ben Lindbergh will be doing a drop-in after hours, sort of a book club, but we'll talk White Lotus, Severance, and baseball and other things. Almost too much to mention. Or just get the show ad-free. That's available, too, at subscribe.mikepesca.com. That's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Michelle Pesca is CBSO of Peachfish Productions. Oompuru Jeepuru Doopuru. Thanks for listening.